One of the most familiar depictions of Arab culture in Europe is Verdi's 1871 opera Aida, commissioned to celebrate the opening of the Royal Opera House in Cairo. But there's a lot more to Arab literature's influence in Europe, and we're going to tap into some of it this time around on University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. With me is Samuel England, professor of Arabic literature at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
It's a great pleasure, Norman. Thank you very much.
Well, your research has covered a lot of territory, from what I can tell, some of it going back quite a long ways. And, of course, there is a very long tradition of Arabic literature, both in Europe and, of course, in other places. How far back would you like to go in this discussion?
Well, I had prepared a bit of 13th century material. We can go back a good ways before that, of course, as far as the literary tradition would allow us. And I certainly, you know, dabble in material going back to before Islam. But the 13th century is an awfully good time. That is the 13th century on the Gregorian calendar. So we're talking about seven centuries into the Islamic calendar, and it's as good a place as any, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, if we went back to the 13th century in English literature, it would be pretty difficult for a contemporary reader of English to fathom a lot of it. Would that be true of Arabic literature also?
Not really. If you have a foundation in studying literary Arabic, really the kind of Arabic that we teach in our, you know, beginning Arabic courses here at UW, you are pretty well prepared, as long as you keep a fair number of dictionaries with you, to read the old stuff and to read pre-modern Arabic. Now, the example that I'd pick from the 13th century is an exception because it's in spoken Arabic. It's in the Arabic that we think was spoken around Granada at that time. What's so telling about that example is that you repeat a line or two from that poem to modern Arabs, and a lot of them not only can understand it, but they recognize it thanks to pop culture. But if we're talking about the sort of standardized material that we teach in classes, a lot of that is based on the transition that Arabic made to, quote-unquote, modernize itself about 150 years ago. And the canonical basis for that was classical Arabic. It was Arabic going back, 1,500 years. Well, let's say 1,200 years from that point. And if you are well educated in an Arab university now, or if you have training in Islamic sources, then you're really well prepared to understand literature over many, many centuries.
Going back that far, and yet this 13th century literature is in pop culture today. That's different.
This one, as far as I can tell, one example from the Diwan of Abul Hasan Shushtari, this Sufi Islamic thinker who has a Diwan that is an entire compendium of his poems available. You could get it in an Arabic bookstore or find it at the library, is the one that has become extremely popular. And I don't pretend to understand all the reasons that this one has become much more popular than his other poems. He's a very popular poet and a thinker with quite a bit of following in Islamic history and Islamic intellectual history. But I don't know quite why this poem has gotten quite a following. I can tell you that there were two very prominent musicians who made it famous in the 1980s. Before that, I think it was probably pretty widely read. And some of that may have to do with what I was talking about before, which is that it's fairly easy to understand, or the choral segment of it, the matla, the part of the poem that you sort of come back to and is repeated throughout the poem and probably sung, is one that if you said it to a Moroccan now, they would basically understand every word, even if they weren't familiar with the poem from before.
That's another thing that's intriguing too, because you're talking about poetry. Did you say it was from Spain?
what we now call Spain, of course, that's a very contested word when it comes to the Middle Ages.
Moved and back and forth quite a bit.
And also, you know, the political understanding of España and the idea of Spain has followed, has been just as political in an academic way as it has been in sort of official big P politics in, say, Spanish state governments or the way that Spanish textbooks have been written. Al-Andalus was how it was known for good 700 years. And most of the peninsula spent a good deal of time under Islamic rule. That word goes back to Vandals, so that's a word that dates back to the idea of Goths in the Iberian Peninsula. So it's sort of inherently a multilingual type word. But Iberian culture, Andalusi culture, having dispersed through mostly through North Africa, but certainly elsewhere, all over the Mediterranean. After the 14th, 15th centuries, and you know, this time of successful Christian armies battling for cities and kicking a huge number of the Muslims and the Jews out, means that a lot of intellectuals and a lot of famous people like Ash-Shuhtari's type, maybe a little bit later than he had traveled from Iberia, populated North Africa, Malta. The sort of coasts of the Mediterranean, and certainly into Egypt, Syria, Palestine, etc.
And what's this poem about, this poem from the 13th century?
It is a tricky poem to say what it's about. Well, it's about a little sheikh. It delineates this little sheikh who's wandering through marketplaces, but the little sheikh is not very descriptively rendered in the poem. He is somebody who says, well, you know, don't speak to me. On the other hand, he's got this little bowl for collecting alms or a little pouch that he's hoping people will throw coins into. And he is the voice. It's his voice that occupies this sort of choral segment of the poem in which he says, basically, I'm antisocial. What do I have to do with people and what do people have to do with me? So, you know, there's a little bit of an irony in the poem.
Yes.
Because it's a very much a communal poem, and yet it's about this guy who says, leave me alone.
And how does it sound?
I'll tell you how this matla sounds. This is how the poem starts. And again, it's kind of what you will come back to. A lot of scholars think that this is a part where the audience would be asked to participate because they would be familiar with this maybe from another poem or another song. It says, and that means a little sheikh from the land of Meknes, that is to say, a Moroccan sheikh, in the middle of marketplaces, goes around singing, what do I have to do with people? What do people have to do with me?
If we looked at a collection of 12th century, 13th century, 14th century European poetry, we'd find, I'm guessing, the bulk of it would be, if we're talking lyric poetry, would be devotional. Some of it might be what we'd call today romantic poetry. How would you characterize the bulk of Arab poetry in the Middle Ages?
That's a great question. There is so much of it. I will have to kind of hazard the furthest reaching of guesses here. There is court poetry, a lot of which is extolling the virtues of a patron. So, you know, that's something that people who are interested in European poetry would be familiar with. And the most highly paid poetry tended to be that type. There is devotional poetry like this, and there's a great deal of it. Ash-Shuhtari ended up traveling to Egypt eventually and was a venerated figure there. The Sufi, the mystical community, in Egypt was prosperous over many centuries, and would center around these kind of holy men like Eshushtari, who gained a great deal of popularity even among people who didn't necessarily explicitly call themselves, you know, Sufi, mystical Muslims. And so they account for a great deal of poetry. One of his forebears, named Ibn al-Arabi, who is enormously famous as a writer of prose and as a poet, wrote what looked to be sort of secularly styled devotional poems in which he talks about his beloved. So love poetry was extremely popular, and he seems to be taking advantage of that for the purposes of writing devotional poetry. All of which is to say, I don't know if it's a great answer to your question, there's a great deal of overlap between genres, and you know, you have stuff that also is meant, it's called Hamasa poetry, or there are collections of poetry called Hamaset that are meant for sort of rallying the troops and getting your empire ready for battle, or convincing your caliph or your king or your prince that they were going to vanquish their enemies. This kind of poem itself belongs to a body of poetry, a lot of which is secular, as far as we can tell. But again, you know, this was a very religious thinker who authored this one.
Is there epic poetry also?
There is. The epics spent a good deal of time circulating, and not many of those manuscripts seemed to survive, if indeed they circulated at the origin point of epics. But there is some great epic poetry, and there's a lot of popular, that is to say, kind of, you know, working class or popular among, you know, the peasantry type epic poetry about the feats of kings. There was a Egyptian Circassian Mamluk king whose exploits from the latter part of the Crusades are the subject of an epic. And actually a really great heroine figure, a woman who had the epithet Dhat al-Himma. Dhat al-Himma means she who has a great deal of strength or personal resolve, took a lot of interest in fighting. And she was supposed to be a royal figure. And there's actually very good new scholarship coming out on her epic now.
I guess rhyme is kind of considered old-fashioned in a lot of poetry today, English language poetry anyway. But of course, back in the day, it served as a great way, and we'll be getting into this a little bit deeper later, I think. But rhyme was a good way to assist in the memorization of a poem, or in the case of something like, say, Beowulf, an epic, they would use alliteration in each line as kind of the memorizer's guide. But what kind of indications do we have that these Arab poems were memorized?
That was probably the main way that a poem like the one that I sampled by Eshushtari would have circulated. You know, paper was fairly expensive. Papyrus was expensive. You had populations who loved poetry but didn't necessarily read. And memorization was, you know, something we can only imagine how much more quickly it probably came to people who, you know, lived a life without reading and writing, and how much more natural that would have felt to them. It's probably all the easier for a poem like Eshushtari's, which was probably sung. We don't have any of the written music to it. The monorhyme of mainstream classical Arabic poetry meant that there wasn't a lot of surprise waiting for you from line to line, and the meter tends to be pretty solid as well. So I don't know. That might make it easier to memorize. It might make it a little bit more of a slog if you're talking about a 250-line poem. Sometimes you have to make somebody, like a pupil in school, memorize a poem, but there is no doubt that people liked remembering poetry, liked reciting it, and it's hard to imagine the poetry surviving as well as it has without that centuries-long trend.
Was there another poem from Alshishtari that you wanted to illuminate?
Not that I have handy. So this kind of gets us into the whole reason that I had thought that maybe I would discuss Alshishtari with you and with listeners is that this poem has had this sort of extraordinary modern life because musicians have taken interest in it in the 1980s. Two major Bahraini musicians got a hold of it, put it to music, and one of them is a very famous oud player, lute player, and singer, and that became an 80s pop hit. There is a sort of Palestinian heartthrob figure now who won Arab Idol very famously, and now there's a whole film about it, Mohammed Asif. I noticed when I was looking up this poem, when he did a concert in Morocco, there's somebody who comes up from backstage and drapes him in a Moroccan flag, and that's very common because he's a very much a national figure for Palestinians, and he's working the crowd, and he drapes this Moroccan flag over his shoulders, and he says, well, I want to give you a little bit of Moroccan material now. Now, how about this one? And of course, he does this Shuwayh song as arranged and as written for instruments by these two Bahraini artists from the 1980s. Alshishtari's poetry, to my knowledge, hasn't had another one kind of jump off like that into pop culture. And because Sufi poetry is not really something I've dedicated much of my long-term research to. The reason I came onto this is because I was writing an article about contemporary Palestinian poetry, and I was reading a book by another Palestinian, this one who writes non-lyrical poetry, and he's gotten to be a pretty big deal. And I noticed that he had written a bunch of poems when he was staying in Spain, and one of them quotes this same poem. So it's this poem punches way above its weight for a poet like Alshishtari, who has a diwan that's probably got more than 100, I don't know how many hundred poems in it. This poem really sort of dominates his repute and his fame in the late 20th and early 21st century.
And this is what it sounds like in a 20th century rendition, a little bit of this, and the artist again is?
He's most associated with an artist named El Jumeiri, and Ahmed El Jumeiri is, I think he's still active on the oud playing and singing scene. It's not totally clear to me that he actually wrote the music for it, and the indications that I have suggest that it's a little bit of a collaboration, but he released it. He has toured on the strength of this song. And many, many years ago, when I was first studying this poem, I mentioned to a friend of mine from the Emirates this poem. He started singing it. And I said, well, how could you know a tune, because we've lost all the music associated with this stuff originally. And he said, no, this is Bahraini guy's song, and my parents used to play it a lot on our old tape player, and here's what it sounds like.
مش علي انا من الناس مش على الناس مني
شيخ من ارضي ما تناس وسط الاسواق مني مش علي انا من الناس مش على الناس مني
ايش علي يا صاحب من جميع الخلايق افعل الخير تنجو واتبعه للحقايق اش علي يا صاحب من جميع الخلايق افعل الخير تنجو واتبعه للحقايق لا تقل يا ابني كلمة الا ان كنت صادق لا تقل يا ابني كلمة الا ان كنت صادق خذ كلامي في قرطاس واكتب وحرز عني اش علي انا من الناس واش على الناس مني
Hear a slightly different interpretation of the same poetry when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Samuel England, and we're talking about the influence of Arab poetry, Arab literature in Europe. And having teased that second rendition of what we just heard from a 13th century Arab poet, his poetry set to music, let's hear, I'm going to say, a slightly different version of the same thing, but also contemporary.
Ardi metnas ustilas
So in addition to Ahmed al-Jumeiri performing this and getting himself quite a hit in the 1980s, we think written the music written by Khaled al-Sheikh, his sort of neighbor, Rajab Muhammad, who's a Kuwaiti singer and actor, also has performed it quite movingly and in a live televised version. So I thought that would be a helpful addition to kind of get a little more of an overview of the interpretations of this one song. We've got the same composer of the music in the 1980s, but of course it had caught on enough that more than one artist kind of wanted to take a shot at it. And hers is, I think, you know, pretty great as a way of hearing another interpretation. And it also sort of plays on the sort of gender dynamics of the way a poem like this would be written. A lot of the choruses, again, this is conjectural territory, but scholars think a lot of the choruses were supposed to be a feminine voice, and you would have a sort of masculine voice speaking to it. So you have a bit of call and response. And she flips this because she is singing this from beginning to end, and her chorus, as it were, the group of people kind of clapping, doing percussion, and doing response to her call are men seated around her.
Now that we've heard two versions of it, Sam, what's the name of the song?
Shuwayih min Ardi Meknes. Some people I have found refer to it just as Ardi Meknes, which means literally the land of Meknes, the city in Morocco, but idiomatically the city of Meknes in central Morocco. Usually you go by the first line of a poem. That's how you identify poetry in this period. So Shuwayih min Ardi Meknes, a little sheikh from the city of Meknes.
Now let's maybe go forward at least, or no, I guess we're going backward musically from the late 20th, 21st century into the world of opera, but there have been some considerable cultural exchanges, let's say, in the world of opera?
For sure. Opera remains quite popular, at least in major Arab capitals. The opera houses tend to be pretty impressive. That was a way of sort of putting your stamp if you were a national government or you were looking to nationalize culture in the wake of colonialism. Of course, there are a lot of colonial buildings as well. And relatively speaking, in the arts budgets of countries, let's say, take Egypt, for example, or Syria as another example, they tend to be relatively well-funded. Of course, Aida is the most famous example of overlap between the Italian convention of opera and the emerging polity that Egypt very much wanted to be in the late 19th century.
Of course, the building of the Suez Canal, although it did not inspire the opera Aida, it certainly opened up European thinking to things Egyptian and, I suppose, things in the Arab world in general.
Yes, and it certainly inspired the person who was trying to fund everything, including the building of the opera house, and that's the Khedive Ismail. Ismail Pasha is another title that he takes. So Khedive means the governor, the ruler of Egypt. It's a political term that's sort of particular to Egypt in this Ottoman period, sort of a semi-autonomous ruler, and he was making money, at least for a short time, hand over fist due to cotton and the fact that the American Civil War had depressed supplies very badly of cotton around the world, to a lesser degree sugar as well. And Egypt was the beneficiary of that kind of world economic picture. So for a while anyway, when he was flush with cash, his ambitions for what he wanted to build in Egypt and how he saw Egypt's role in the world went
so
bananas. And he saw the opera house as a way to place a stamp on what was ultimately a much more efficacious building project, which was the digging of the Suez Canal, which of course is not stopped being essential to world
was
economic
opera
flows.
A genre that Arab cultures embraced, either in terms of the settings that they would choose for the opera or language? I mean, were these European-style operas that somehow got picked up by composers in Arab countries, or is it something different when you talk about going to the opera house in an Arab country?
That would come later. That sense of popularity among the middle classes to go see an opera, to go see musical theater in a fairly grand building, that would catch on. Ismail was famously out of touch with the populace in general, and that was part of his downfall. But he was a very, very close student of what he thought worked for European societies. And when I say worked, I basically mean what would make him seem like a grand figure and would make Egypt seem like a sort of proper piece of the overall European cultural and economic matrix. And he saw opera as being essential to that. I don't think that there was a huge amount of popularity. In fact, pretty much know that there was not a lot of popular demand for opera at the time, but there certainly was an interest in doing sort of middle-class rituals, carrying out middle-class rituals like a walk along the Corniche, and there was a sort of a big lake in that area where he built the opera. A lot of it he sort of dredged out, but all of that is pretty close to the Nile as well, so that you would take an evening stroll and you might stop for a glass of whiskey. Again, this is the sort of stereotype
of
the middle class.
Doesn't play that well with Islam, does it?
True, but whiskey remains popular in a lot of Islamic societies, and you know, whiskey is just one example. The big business that would emerge around that time was actually brewing beer. You know, Egypt had a fairly natural agricultural fit for the production of beer because they raised
for domestic consumption
barley, and it was a Belgian interest. And it's been nationalized since. So you can, you know, out in Egypt, you know, you pick your spot, but you can get a Stella beer. And of course, the fact that it's called Stella, and we have this other brand of Stella that's sold worldwide, is not entirely coincidental.
What about the role of women as we get into the world of the 19th century and opera in the Arab context?
That's a great question. I think that opera as a sort of unit, that is to say, opera as somebody like Giuseppe Verdi would have viewed it, held sway. And if that calls for women performers, which of course it did, then so be it. The modes of performance in the popular sphere, things that were not opera, you know, the sort of performances that might take place with, you know, flute playing and people singing along, or, you know, a very small troupe that would play in kind of more of a much less grand sort of hall if they're playing in a building, or be invited into a villa to come give a private performance. There may have been a good deal of mixing of gendered roles there, but I'm not entirely sure. I think there was no question that opera needed to be sort of imported, basically, you know, according to the models that were already laid
down. Influence of European music in general in Arab countries?
My firsthand experience is mostly derived from living in Egypt, Syria, and in Lebanon, and Western music is very popular in all of those places.
Popular, but does it infuse into Arab music itself, or is it a separate thing?
You know, if we're talking about pop culture now, you know, you have technologies for making music that, you know, make it relatively accessible, you know, things like autotune that, you know, whereas a couple decades ago would have been really, really incredibly expensive to set up, and you'd need a studio and all that, to people, you know, making beats and doing stuff in their bedrooms and such. The traditional binary between Western and Eastern instruments production, maybe even scales, I think doesn't hold up terribly well now. I want to caution that this gets a little bit outside of my field of expertise. I mean, I'm certainly not a musicologist, so, you know, a certain amount of this I would defer to people with more training. I can reflect on what I've heard and experienced. The thing about lyrical works is, you know, I go with my strengths, which is, you know, for better or for worse, seeing it on paper. And I happen to tune into the radio as well.
What about the flip side of that question then, since we're talking about the Arab influence in Europe, in terms of the poetry, in terms of the literature, especially in the 19th century, I think there was an interest in European countries for kind of a world experience, whether it was, you know, getting back to the opera with Puccini and Madama Butterfly, or it was picking up bits of poetry and building upon this poetry from other countries. What would you cite? And of course, there's a lot of architectural influence if you look at the Alhambra and things like that in Spain. But what sort of influence do we see of Arab literature in Europe?
Goethe and company were intensely interested in Arabic, Persian, Urdu literature as part of this divan, this kind of, you know, world repository of aesthetic knowledge that they wanted to put together. Of course, that takes us back a few centuries. In European and, say, North American literature now, there is a good deal of very popular literature that identifies very strongly, say, you know, through the author's own identity with Arab culture. But it seems to me you might be asking more about the forms and whether the forms have sort of had legs, so to speak, and have traveled from, say, Arab places where Arabic literature was being composed and where its primary audience was, to a secondary audience who might then want to adopt some of its norms for their own literature, say in Europe or in the Americas?
Sure. Forms in longer pieces, storylines, that kind of thing?
The central point, I would say, the sort of Polaris of all this would probably be the 1001 Nights.
Oh, sure.
1001 Nights is, even when you get to Arabic, you are talking about something that didn't start off in Arabic at all. But Arabs, as far as we know, were the first ones to write down the stories. And it's clear when you look at the manuscripts as Arabs give, you know, examples in Iraq and in Syria from quite a few centuries ago, bear the traces of a great deal of editing and a great deal of Islamicizing. So you get the sense that there are storylines involving, you know, say a traveler, you know, somebody like Sinbad, or a king and a queen who are clearly not Arabs, but are constantly saying, well, thank God, the Lord of the two worlds, that I got to my house safely after that adventure. And that's a calque, you know, that's a saying that is clearly Islamic. Teasing out what these stories might have been like before they traveled from Indochina to Arabic-speaking kingdoms is a lifetime of work, and I have colleagues who have committed themselves to doing it. We then, of course, get to more the crux of your question, which is it takes off in popularity in Europe and becomes absolutely fascinating to European intellectuals, to, say, middle-class Parisians who are hosting 1001 Night theme parties and these kind of masquerade balls where you dress up like you imagine these sumptuous palaces looking like, to, you know, to Disney in the 1990s coming out with Aladdin. That's a great teaching tool I found for my students about this fascination. Sure.
Well, so yes, far and wide influences in places we wouldn't right away think of. We'll look further at the influence of Arab literature in Europe and get some more music in there too when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Samuel England, professor of Arabic literature at the UW-Madison, and we've been talking about the influences back and forth between Arabic literature in Europe and vice versa. We touched earlier on this whole idea of memorization of poetry. What's in it for you, Sam?
Well, it's a little bit of a hat tip, I guess, to those who came before, because the way that Arabic was taught, especially to native speakers, so the way that formal Arabic was taught in schools in Arab countries often involved lots and lots of memorization. And that could be the kind that would absolutely torture a kid, and it could also be the kind that would unlock your mind into the beauties and the depths of a poetic composition, because you're memorizing everything from the way that, you know, a verb breaks down with its you know, tri-radical structure to, you know, a poem that was composed 1,000 years ago and, you know, 1,000 ships sailed on the strengths of its words, or people were, you know, brought to tears in the middle of the court. And you're sort of reliving some of that when you try to commit it to memory. I had a lot of mentors who had grown up in going to, you know, Arabic schools, had grown up, say, getting Islamic education, who just had this astonishing range of poems that they had memorized. And I didn't do quite that much, but as one of their students, I did a little bit because they insisted on it.
And you spent, what, about 2 years of your childhood in Egypt mostly?
That's right. When I was a little kid, I was there for 2 years, ended up going back, of course, you know, when I got kind of serious about studying Arabic and such as an adult, as a college student, as a graduate student, and had family living there. But those 2 years were definitely in an American school. And in fact, they didn't even teach Arabic at that school. It's called Cairo American College. They didn't at the time teach Arabic until you got into the fourth grade. I left at the end of third grade. Now, I think they've kind of rectified that, or I would call it rectifying that. I think now they do Arabic for all non-native speakers from the get-go, from kindergarten on. I could be wrong about that. But, you know, it was sort of a missed opportunity that I guess I've tried to make up for.
Does it help in memorizing poetry? I think this would be true for English language poetry. I don't know about Arabic, though. Does it help to actually have it written down?
Well, probably for little kids, it helps less, and I'm sure for some of them is not even necessary at all. Just, you know, the young imagination and memory is so flexible and sponge-like. I can tell you that I definitely needed it written down to work on it, because I would need to take it home and sort of do it sort of the boring way, which was go line by line and see if I got the vowels right and, you know, sort of pound it the way I would do any kind of task-based homework. It gets fun, of course, once you get a little bit deeper into a poem and it starts to flow and you start to anticipate the next line just as soon as you finish the one before it.
We have this other musical example that you have pulled, which I think is very different from the other two. certainly charming in its own way, and also a latter-day rendering of an earlier Arab text?
So this musician, Saïd Messi, from Algeria, did something I think that I just have to tip my cap to her. She came out with this album called Al Mutakallimun, which they've translated as the Masters of the Word. There's a lot of translations for that word. To be a mutakellim can mean being a scholar of a certain type of theology, but generally it means somebody who commits themselves to doing something beautiful or doing something empirically deep with Arabic language. And she surveys a great deal of Arabic poetry historically, stylistically, on this album, but I thought I would pick out this one in which she's put to music El Mutanebbi, who was a poet. He kind of reached the pinnacle of his career in Iraq and Syria, and a poem that basically anybody with an Arabic education, if you quote, you know, this one or two lines from this one work of his, they might not be able to tell you the first line of the poem, that is the thing that we come up with in lieu of a title of each poem, but they can definitely finish that line for you. That this couple of lines has just become emblematic of sort of Arabic poetry writ large. I think, like a lot of parents who try to raise their kid with more than one language, I am totally failing at this. I have a young child, and you know, I'll say "giblik shwayt aish," like I'll bring you a little bit of bread or something like that. And I'll say no Arabic, no Arabic, just English.
Really,
and it breaks my heart. But something I realized is El Mutanebbi's poem. He got really into it. So I was giving him a bath one night, and despairing at my inability to to get through bath time without a disaster, and I just started. I don't know why I started doing this, but I just started saying El khaylu wal laylu wal bayda'u ta'rifuni, and in his own way, not necessarily nailing all the pronunciation, he starts doing it. And so now if I come up to him and I say El khaylu, he'll say wal laylu, and I just get such a kick out of that, because this is not everyday Arabic. This is not the kind of Arabic that you use to order coffee or something like that in. But for whatever reason, it can give a 2-year-old pleasure, and it can give you pleasure as a kid at an Arabic primary school. And it certainly people's faces light up when they go through this line of poetry.
Children enjoy repetition, don't they?
I think the length of the syllables have got to help, but. It's all guesswork.
Here it is in music.
يعلم الجمع ممن ضم مجلسنا بأنني خير بمن تسعى به قدمه. Bien sûr, c'est pas moi qui ai écrit ces vers, c'est El Mutanebbi. On a mis en musique le beau poème de Mutanebbi, El Khaylu wal Laylu. Et je vous laisse découvrir ça. A plus. El Khaylu wal Laylu, wal Baydaou ta'rifouni, wal Seyf wal Rouhou, wal Qirtas wal Khalou.
More Arab poetry in a very contemporary musical context there. I know you have done some research on the political leaders in Arab countries and their perceived need to tap into ancient Arabic culture and as a way to bond with their people or somehow legitimize themselves in terms of the tradition of Arab culture. What have you discovered?
Well, secular rulers perform a little bit of sleight of hand, I think. I think that they tend to portray themselves as installing a new order that is more or less based on a blank slate, that is, it's not held down by the conventions of the past. Now, that's one way that they sort of sell themselves. It's pretty clear the more you read about them and especially read about the sort of cultural programming that their ministries of culture performed for him in this otherwise, you know, very kind of sleek, modern capital of Baghdad. So, you know, that's kept my attention from book to book. It's kind of the way that I ended my first book and has left such a kind of a little bit of sand in the oyster or something like that, that I've wanted to return to it and develop it into a fuller length book, which is what I'm working on now.
Well, it's been a fast scamper through a little bit of Arabic culture, literature in particular, and its influence in Europe and vice versa. And a great pleasure, Samuel England.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate the time.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Arab.